king of Kuzar and the Chover are in the middle of discussing the Torah's tradition. Oh, welcome. The Torah's tradition of, you know what? For a smaller crowd, I'm going to move over here.
Just be easier.
Okay. The king of Kuzar and the Chover are in the middle of discussing the Torah's tradition of world history. And right now, the Chover brought home the point, this is where we're holding. If you're looking for it inside, we're basically in Eis Nun Hei. The Chover brought home the point, Nun Zayin, that Moshe Rabbeinu was coming with very, very presumptuous claims in the Torah. He was basically coming, and in the Torah, by presenting the Torah's tradition of world history, he's telling the people that 500 years earlier, all of civilization developed. And all the great nations that were known at the time, Moshe is coming and professing to say that, well, this all evolved 500 years ago, it was all just one big nation, and this one had that child, and this one had that child, and this nation came from this, and that nation came from that. Which is completely preposterous if it wasn't true. Because 500 years ago, in history, 500 years is a very short time. You see already in those times, it's not just in our times that we have better records. You see already in those times, they had plenty of artifacts and evidence of the goings on 500 years ago. There's no way somebody can come and make up stories about the origins of all the nations in the world and of such major events as Migdal Babel, where all the nations of the world, which were initially just one nation, and sell that in a large scale without being laughed out of court. That's where we stand now. And this is another example of the soundness of the Torah's tradition. The fact that it was accepted shows that the people were familiar with these events. Okay, and that's, by the way, as we mentioned last week.
Question, why then does nobody else have such a tradition?
What's that?
Do other groups have a tradition of a Migdal Babel?
Do other groups have?
If this was an historical event, that all of you.
At the time. At the time. At the time. Meaning at the time, or people, he's asserting that people at the time were familiar with these events. I don't know if do we have any records of it continuing till now.
Everybody lost it except for us. Yeah, right.
I don't know.
Many cultures.
He fled, but a lot of it. I'm talking about
the Migdal Babel. I don't know. I also don't know in general how much do we have by today of that period. I don't know. I think that from the earliest documented things that they have, basically date that back to about to the time of a king called Hammurabi, who is often identified as Nimrod. I think that's one of the earliest.
Code of Hammurabi.
What's that?
Nimrod wrote the Code of Hammurabi.
I don't know what the Code of Hammurabi is, but the man, Hammurabi, the man, he was a king. I'm sure that the suggestion is that it's broken down from the words Hamu Rabi, which has to do with the sun being the god. Hamu is related to the word Chama. Rabi, Ribain, really in those times. Okay. So now, but you know what? Even if we're not going to go with that, he's going to make a couple of points. Now, where we're up to now, he's going to make a couple of points that are very just interesting to note, food for thought. This is where we are now. So last week we ended by him asking the king. He said, again, we're coming with a very, very fantastic assertion that there used to only be one language, and that people were then scattered, and that's where all the other languages were born. So he ended by asking him, have you ever seen a language being invented? And the king answered that no. Languages seem to defy identifying their origin, while they clearly are not natural. Languages are not natural. We see that different nations have different languages, which is an intrigue. And now he points out the following. Omar Achover, Hashamato al Umo Shecholekes v'Shavua. So you might say, sure, different nations have different languages. You know why? Because they're all of different origins. They don't come from the same ancestor. Maybe they all evolved from different sources. Gorillas gave way to ultimately became the Europeans, and giraffes gave way to ultimately became the Africans, etc. And that's also why different languages developed. So,
that we come from animals?
What's that?
That we come from animals?
No, maybe you would say that, yeah, the different languages represent the fact that we don't necessarily all come from the same ancestor. So, there's also room here. So now he says, "Amar Achave, Hashamato al Uma Shecholekes b'Shavua Hayadua." This is an interesting point to note. We can get closer. You want to come over here? You here? Okay, good. Oh, have you ever heard of any nation that works with a different cycle than the week, a different cycle than the 7 day cycle? I understand that at one point in history, in France, I think, they considered using something else, but it dropped immediately.
Napoleon what was it? Proposed a 10-day week.
Oh yeah, that's what happened?
10-day week, 3 weeks a month.
And what happened? Well, I think it held for about 2 weeks or something?
I don't know.
Well, it didn't even get that far. But it didn't work. So whatever it is, have you ever heard of any nation that goes with anything other than the week? Now not only do they all go with the 7 day cycle, but it's also the same 7 days. The week begins on Sunday, ends on Saturday, all around the world. Every last nation. Hayitachen sheyishvu beze anshei atzin im anshei yeh hamarav. Is it possible that somehow the most scattered nations, the Chinese, got together with the Western nations at some point back in history, and there was a universal agreement to work with this system? How could this have become that way without a universal agreement? But at which point in history would there have been a universal agreement? It's an inexplicable phenomenon. Omar Kuzari. So Kuzari says, "Lo yitochin ze el baskama min hakol." This can obviously only work if everybody around the globe agreed. Now that's inconceivable, but the fact is that this is how it is. The other possibility is that maybe it all originated from one source. Maybe all men originated from the same place. And that's where the week began. Maybe they all come from Nadam or Noach. What do you know? Or someone else. Maybe the week is simply continuing directly from that first common ancestor. Ah. So the Chaver answers, that's what I was getting at. That's what I wanted to hear. We have a very strong indication that all of mankind originates from the same source. While at the same time, for some reason, languages are not common to all of mankind. Why did this hold and that not hold? It's indicative of something, isn't it? Torah has good answers. V'chein minyan ha'asara, another phenomenon. Isn't it interesting that all around the world, the number 10 is the main dividing number? Hiskim kol adam alav v'mizrach u'b'marav. Everyone goes with that, from east to west. Eze teva yovi lamoi ba'asara. What is natural about the number 10 that should be what's used to divide? 10 fingers. That's an interesting suggestion, I hear. I still don't think it explains that all across the world that would be agreed upon by every nationality.
Exceptions.
What's that?
There are exceptions.
Are there?
60 minutes in an hour.
No, I mean, well, even 60 minutes in an hour is still based on 60.
Right, but they don't have a mathematical system based off the 16th.
Right, right, right. But at the end of the day, it's still a round number of 10. 12 hours to the day is not, and 7 hours, etc. But when we're talking about serious math, it's always going to be based on tens. I'm not talking about that anything we do is based on tens. We have a 7 day week. Right?
Yeah.
Based on tens. Well, you're going to get into the inches, but man, what? And that actually corroborates our point. Because don't say that mathematically that's what makes most sense. Because actually, you see that when you're dealing with computers, if they don't know human chokhmahs, it doesn't work with 10. What does it work with? I forgot what it works with.
Two. Binary.
Oh, okay. So apparently, this also somehow was agreed upon. Arbitrary. It's not something that needs to be. Obviously, this is a continued chain that started with one source. So he's making some good arguments. This is really not the central argument, but these are interesting arguments that are very indicative of the Torah's tradition. So Amar Kuzari. So now the Kuzari kind of switches, still on the same subject of the Torah's tradition, but now he's questioning another element of it. Ve'echwa yafgim alecha emunascha. How are you not shaken? Meaning, I do have a problem with your tradition. Masha oimrim al anche hoidu. That they say that among the people of India, ki mekaymes yesh etzlam, they have places, ubinyanim, and they have buildings. Ubarul etzlam ki yesh lem meis alfei shana. They have buildings that they identify as being 100,000 years old. How does this work with the Torah's tradition? Here is a building that's 100,000 years old. Once we're on the subject, we'll quote Reb Shlomo. Can you hear us from back there? You can also sit over here. Reb Shlomo Brevd is a Zichrono Livracha. When he was talking about the age of the world at one point, he said that the governor of New Hampshire must be a very, very old man. Because there's a park in New Hampshire where they show you a certain block of stones, and they say this block, it says there's a sign, this block of stone is, I forgot, some sort of astronomical amount of years old. 10 million years old, signed by the governor of New Hampshire. The governor of New Hampshire must be a very old man. But whatever it is, here in India they have buildings that it says on them they're 100,000 years old. So Omar HaChover. So the Chover answers, this would constitute a problem for me. We would find this among a well-established nation. It would be a solid nation, a sound nation, or some serious literary source, which is well, whose authority is well agreed upon. Without it being subject to debate. That we don't have. What do we have? Achem Uma Mufkeres. They're a barbaric, primitive nation. Ain't it Slumdover Boru? They don't have anything clear. Meaning, basically, that whole culture is built on all kinds of different funny stories and myths and legends. They mach isim es anche atoyers. And anybody who does have a clear tradition, they just make them crazy. Meaning, the Kmai Elo Advarim, meaning these people are just a thorn in the side for anybody with orderly religion. But these people just have sloppy, haphazard religions, all kinds of conflicting myths, and anybody who's trying to make sense out of things, and is trying to really record things in a serious way, just finds that he can't deal with it. The same way they just annoy everybody who tries to study their culture with their different idols and their statues and all their different forms of service. They come and say, this form of incense does this for us and that does that for us, and nobody serious can manage with what they talk about. So we're talking about a primitive bunch who work with a bunch of myths and there's nothing serious about them. And they completely ridicule any concept of a divine sefer. Meaning, they have all kinds of ideas, but they themselves ridicule the concept of a divine sefer. What? Sefer. Meaning, they don't even agree with the concept of a Torah coming from God. There is no text coming from God. All they have is a collection of myths that they have from a whole bunch of different versions of tradition. And yes, every different group has their different legends, so nobody takes them seriously. They have certain books that certain individuals wrote of records of world history, each one with his own story. And the only people who take these books are, it's like tabloid history records. And only gullible people go for it. Like they have certain astrological books, in which they record events that happened over the last tens of thousands of years. We're dealing with different cultures and we're not familiar with. But he says, yes, there's a book of the Nevati doctrine. They also have their own parshias and their own history, and they have figures also which go date back tens of thousands of years. These Nevatim, I don't know. Possibly. I don't know who it is. And they have names like Yanbusha, Vitzagris. What?
It translates it here as
Nabataean. Nabataeans. Oh, there you go. The Gawani, yes, they have all kinds of great names of people who lived 10,000 years ago. Vamukayu, Kaidam Adam. They have Adam in their records too, but he appeared later in history. Vishayanbusha, Rabbi Shal Adam Arishain. They even have on record who Adam Arishain's teacher was. It was a guy named Yanbusha who taught Adam Arishain. Vadoimel is there. Okay. And they have all kinds of other such stories. But Lamaisa, they don't have any organized, well-established record of anything. And therefore, the bottom line is, you're challenging me with traditions that are very, very weak, feeble, and I don't really see the need to relate to that.
Is that the Chaver
answering?
Now,
this is the Chaver answering. So in other words, the Chaver was easily able to get out of the question of, we have people saying that the world is older. Now, we won't be able to answer it that way. Right? He says, well, all these records of the world being 10,000 years old, 100,000 years old, are just by a bunch of primitive barbarians who don't have anything straight. That's not going to work for us. But let's see how the Kuzari continues. Amar Kuzari. So the Kuzari says, all right, as long as you're dealing with cults, you're right that you don't have to relate to their traditions. Okay. But, Amar Kita Anti Olecha Ba'umum of Keras. Okay, you're right, your answer is correct, as long as I was only questioning you based on some primitive nation. And a nation that can't even get one story together, they're divided into a bunch of sects, each with their own story. And you answered, well, you don't really have to relate to them. It's not our job to go disproving every last cult that exists. You have to make the grade in order to be related to seriously. In order to be disproved, I'm going to have to disprove everything. But matoima b'philosophy. But he says, one minute, you have a whole separate front to contend with. What are you going to say about the philosophers? The philosophers represented the epitome of intellectuality of the time. Behem, kasher heim, they reached their conclusions min amechkar ve'hadikduk. By intense study, intense analysis. So there you can't just say, well, they're a primitive bunch who can't get their act together. Here you're dealing with a formidable force. The Eskimo, and they did reach the conclusion that al hanatzchus vehakadmus la'olam, that the world always was. Remember, this was science. In earlier times, 1,000 years ago. In the Aristotle and pre-Aristotle period. This was the accepted view of the intelligentsia. This is after Aristotle, but it's still under the influence of his teachings. It's before his teachings were debunked. And here you're not contending with tens of thousands and not even with millions of years. You are now have to contend with no beginning at all. The world always was. In other words, what he's asking is, what are you going to say to refute the findings of modern science? That's what he's asking the Khuzar. Now, I find it important to stress that, because we have to remember that the same way we find people today saying, well, look, if that's what all the scientists say, there's got to be something to it. Let's remember that science is always developing. And at an earlier time, that's what all the scientists say meant, that the world never began, it always was. The science is always developing. You have to keep that perspective. Aristotle's theories held sway for a long time. This business about the world always being was dropped at one point in history, but many of his theories held sway for a good 2,000 years before they were dropped. So there's no question that it was intimidating at any point in history to claim that the world began 6,000 years ago. You were contradicting what any rational, normal person understood to be true. So what's the Chavar going to answer? On our Chavar. So the Chavar takes an interesting approach, which is kind of in line with how he started. Ha-philosophim ein lahashim ha-isam. I have nothing against the philosophers. I don't blame them. You know what? From their perspective, they're right. Mipnei sheim am loy nochlu chokhma veloy teira. Because they don't have a tradition. Meaning, they didn't have information about when the world began and how it developed. They had to figure it out by themselves. In trying to figure it out by themselves, they did an admirable job. But they're missing the information. Mipnei sheim yivanim. They don't have the tradition because they're Greeks. The Greeks are from the children of Yefes. They live up north. And the true knowledge, true tradition, which was inherited from Adam Arishay, that Chachma is what is being transmitted through divine assistance, meaning the Chachma did not manage to be retained all across humanity. It was only retained through divine assistance, which ultimately evolved into the Torah. And it's contained by the Torah. But it was lost from much of humanity. All of humanity had the tradition at some point, but different parts of humanity, different branches, lost it at different points. And today it's only alive through where it was divinely sustained. It was only sustained in the seed of Shem, who was the choice of Noach's seed. That divine wisdom, the divine knowledge of the truth of everything, began with Adam and was sustained divinely in the seed of Shem, and it will always continue there. But the rest of mankind drifted away from it and lost touch with it. So you have to realize, the Greeks, what he's really noting is, the Greeks represent some of the greatest of human achievement, greatest achievements of human intellect. But you must remember that it's not wisdom that always was in the Greek nation. Philosophy was born in the Greek nation at a defined point in history. Before that, they were as ignorant and as anybody else. So, let's note, it's not that there are two traditions competing here. It's not that there are two records of world history competing here. There's an unbroken chain of world record, of world history. And then we have, against that, human speculation. When did Yavan gain Chachma? from the time that they started gaining power, and really, the truth is, now he says something a bit bold. Philosophy was not born among the Greeks. The Greeks got it from the nations that they supplanted. They siphoned it, is that how you say it? Siphoned it? Off, what? Good way of putting it. Off the Persians. They were the Persians' historic heirs. And they siphoned the Chachma, the concept of Chachma, off Persia. Velparas Mikazdim. And where did the Persians get it from? They got it from the ones who they supplanted. Bavel. The Babylonians. So really, the whole concept... Oh. So you're asking an educated question. But the Kuzari stops there. So let me first finish a sentence. So he says, the Greeks didn't invent thought. Not only didn't they invent it, they didn't even have it. They learnt it from Persia. The Persians learnt it from the Babylonians. And yeah, the Greeks took the ball and ran with it and accomplished. And yes, at that point, when they inherited it from the Persians, yes, they produced great philosophers. But it was within a defined period of history that they produced their great philosophers, right? Started with Plato, Socrates, Aristotle. They had their time in the sun from the intellectual perspective. And then it stopped. Once the Greeks lost their power, lost their glory, once the Romans moved in on the scene, like that was the end of Greek intellectuality, and we haven't heard of any more philosophers since then, Greek philosophers.
Why should we expect their philosophy to die out?
What's that? He's not saying that it's going to die out. The only thing that he's pointing out is, do not think that the Greeks have some inherent wisdom that was always with them, that they're carrying from the beginning, and that therefore they're privy to information that can compete with ours.
What I'm not hearing is, I understand why they acquired this. They got it from Persia and eventually Masoria, hint, coming from us. But in terms of the fact that Rome conquered them, why should their philosophical enterprise suddenly collapse?
Why should their philosophical enterprise collapse once the Romans conquered? I suppose just that the whole flourishing of philosophy was associated with the success they were having in all areas. As soon as in general they dropped, so all the drive dropped. That would just be my guess. A guess. Okay. Now, as Nehemiah noted, he said, well, the Greeks kind of siphoned it off the Persians siphoned it off the Babylonians, and back to our subject. Where'd the Babylonians get it from? So he spells it out. Here he doesn't get into it, but later he boldly spells it out in the Sefer. And he says, the Babylonians took it from the Jews. Now, it's an assertion that he actually makes, which other Sfarim also discuss, that ultimately the I won't say the conclusions of philosophy and all the philosophical teachings, but the roots of philosophy, meaning the original premises, right, what got the ball going, was ultimately taken by the Goyim from Jewish philosophers. That was where Chachma always was. The Jews were intellectuals. At periods in history when the Goyim weren't interested in intellectuality, b'chlal, and if all of a sudden, at some point in history, suddenly, different nations started popping up with philosophers and with wise men, all of whom always had counterparts in the Jewish people who were able to compete with them, we can assume that the ultimate source is the Jewish people. They were always wise men. Yeah, they were always wise men. They were always scholars, etc. But this concept of world-class philosophers, right, setting down fundamentals of thought for all of history, wasn't as well known then. Here and there, we do have. But it wasn't the whole movement. Now, okay, the other Mepharshim, it's actually interesting, the other Mepharshim here spell it a little more. I found it annoying when everybody has to come and attribute everything to the Jews. Columbus was Betzim Jewish, and this one is Betzim Jewish, that one is Betzim Jewish. Betzim, all of Aristotle's philosophies comes from the Jews. Any success in history, Betzim started with the Jews somehow or the other. Maybe Ford was Jewish. But I found it a little annoying. I'm saying that we have enough of our own. Okay, so there's a compliment by the Goyim too. But it's very interesting that there are some very serious sources who discuss these things. Abarbanel, for example, cites sources. Abarbanel was a big intellectual. He wasn't, you know, cites sources of Aristotle recording discussions that he had with Shimon HaTzadik. There are other sources that cite discussions that Plato had with Ermiel. It's of note, but he says that there was an old pious Jew who settled in Egypt. That's where Plato got to know him. Old pious Jew settled in Egypt and lived to the end of his life in Egypt, and that's where Plato got to know him. Yirmiyahu. So his name was Yirmiyahu. In the actual sources where this comes from, it doesn't say Yirmiyahu Hanavi. Later, as far as said, it was probably Yirmiyahu Hanavi based on the descriptions. It was a Jew by the name of Yirmiyahu. There are some very serious Sfarim that...
Time periods coincide.
What's that?
Time chronologies.
So I understand. Meaning, just Aristotle was Alexander's Rebbe. Alexander learned from Aristotle. Which basically puts him in the time, equates him with Shimon HaTzadik historically. Plato was a couple of days earlier, which basically puts him with Yirmiyahu HaNavi. So... at least in an approximate way, it certainly stimmt. Yeah.
Why would Yirmiyahu teach
Chokhmas Yisrael to a guy? So, as I was saying, there are serious Sfarim who discuss all these things. There are other serious Sfarim that greatly doubt it. Among them is the Mekubo Maram Dilunzano, who says that the whole thing is garbage. All these discussions are garbage. Shimon HaTzadik and Yirmiyahu HaNavi would have no interest in making a point of impressing the non-Jewish philosophers. And Chas v'Shalom to say that the great wisdom of Shlomo somehow continued with Aristotle and the Jews somehow lost track of it. How would that happen? So, he makes light of the whole thing. I'm just bringing it in because it's an interesting point of discussion, because it's discussed very broadly. There's a lot of discussion on it. And there are apparently different sources of documentation on the subject. Actually, Josephus also records some of these discussions. So, it's a controversial subject, but it's a point of interest that I thought was worth mentioning. Whatever it is, back to the Kuzari. The Kuzari certainly does allude, at least to the general concept, and that's certainly easier to accept. I doubt that the Maharam Dilanzano would have been fighting that too. To the general concept that, in general, intellectuality was siphoned off the Jews. Okay, but back to our subject.
Who were some of the early Jewish? Abraham Avinu.
Avraham Avinu, yeah. Okay, whatever it is, where were we holding? That was kind of a tangent. Where were we holding? The Kuzari challenged the Chavar and he said, you can dismiss the traditions of cults, but how can you dismiss the claims of the whole philosophical school of thought? And basically, Kuzari's answer was, note that it's not like there's a race called The Chavar's answer is, first let's put things into perspective. It's not like there's this race called philosophers, and that there's a philosopher Torah that always existed, and now we have to figure out how do we deal with the two competing traditions. No, that's not what happened. There was always a Torah. The Greeks were a primitive and barbaric bunch just like everybody else. At one point in history they woke up, produced philosophers for a couple of hundred years, and then went back to sleep. And they're back asleep now too. So, we're competing with human speculation. So, Omar Kuzari, v'chiz emechayev shalei nami la'aristus v'chochmasoi. So the Kuzari king says, okay, fine. So you're competing with human speculation. But, at the end of the day, you are talking about unbelievable human intellect. You're talking about Aristotle, the greatest of the great. Is it so easy for you to dismiss his claims? And the Chaver says, yes, it's easy for me to dismiss his claims. How's that? Because at the end of the day, like the Kuzari says, it's human speculation. Human speculation, no matter how great it is, it's going to get very far, but it has its limitations. And he's going to show that clearly. He says, look, how did Aristotle arrive at his conclusions? Not because it was clear. A led to B led to C, and therefore the conclusions were clear. Aristotle did a lot of deliberating, right? There were a lot of sphakis that he had to kill himself over. He had to really exert his intellect. What's that?
Did Aristotle have a Rebbe?
He did. His Rebbe, from what I understand, was, if I remember correctly, the Masoretz was Plato, Socrates, Aristotle. Is that correct? Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. What's that?
Did it all start with Socrates, all of this?
Aristotle disagreed with his Rebbe. I mean, he had a Rebbe. He began his philosophical studies under his Rebbe. But in this tradition of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, each one improved, if you will, on the teachings of his Rebbe.
So Socrates did not, we're saying that he did not have a tradition.
No, he didn't have a tradition.
And that's, does he admit that in his writings? Is it like understood that he
did? He's not claiming to have a tradition. He's claiming to have developed his thoughts based on human. That's what philosophy was. That's the greatness of philosophy. The greatness of, yeah, yeah. Or not, not Yishmeyayin, the human intellect at work. Adarabha, that's the greatness of philosophy. The greatness of philosophy is that it's not information absorbed, recorded, and passed on. The greatness of philosophy is the concepts that they were able to develop simply by thinking and discovering truths.
But about the world always being, that's kind of like a cop-out.
Ah. So let's see. That's what he's getting to now. He said, yes, their conclusion was that the world always was. By the way, there was also machlokes between the schools of thought. Both Plato and Aristotle believed in always was. It wasn't a proper creation. Just that Plato believed in it. Aristotle made it a bit coarser. Plato believed that there was something called original substance. Heuli, that from which everything was formed. Now that was formed at some point in history. Call it an early version of evolution. But that Heuli always was. Aristotle said, no, the world as we see it today always was. Yeah, same thing in principle. So now let's see. Tyro-wise, there might be a difference between the two. I mean, one might be a little more acceptable than the other. Might. We'll see. But let's see. What? It's guessing, but it is tremendous because human intellect is tremendous. When human intellect is pushed to the maximum, it's going to discover very great truths. Just, it will not discover everything because human intellect is always limited. But human intellect, when it's maximized, is a force that needs to be contended with. It can't be brushed aside.
But if it's based on falsehood, then it's the product of falsehood.
If it's based on, but why are you saying that in this context? Are you suggesting that the philosopher's thought was based on falsehood?
No, he's not guessing. It's
guessing.
Guessing.
Yeah, that's what he was. But the guessing
that's
is
a scientific method.
Okay. So let's see. Let's see what the Chaver says. He says, I do allow myself to dismiss Aristotle's findings. Because he exerted his mind. In other words, what you're saying is they weren't sitting with the laboratory and microscopes. They were thinking.
Yeah,
speculation.
Thinking in a vacuum. Exactly.
Okay, let's see.
The idea pops into your head. You can just go with that. But
let's see. Let's see. Okay. The reason Aristotle had to exert his intellect was because he had no other resource. He wasn't handed the facts, and therefore he had to go try to figure it all out himself. Now, so he tried to figure out, this is kind of what you're saying, he tried to figure out, well, Right? Sat down one day. Today we're going to figure out how the world started. Thought. Was it me? I know it wasn't me who made it. Okay. Considered whatever possibilities he might have considered. He had nothing to begin with, right? No basis to begin with. He considered the possibilities of how the world began, how it would end. He could not come up with a plausible explanation of the world beginning. We have to understand that it wasn't like Aristotle had a clear train of thought that brought him to an unquestionable conclusion. He was struggling with two equally inconceivable possibilities. Beginning, he couldn't conceive of any plausible explanation of a beginning. So what are you going to say? That there was no beginning, it always was? That's equally implausible. But one of the two must be. Because there is a world, can't get around that. Later philosophers came and said, maybe that's not true either. Right? Maybe we're all just imagining ourselves. Someone proved it from the genius observation that I think because I am, and I am because I think. I don't know. Yeah. I pinch myself and therefore I hurt. So, but whatever it is, what's that? Just think it though. Right. So, whatever it is, it's not, don't think that, like you said, it wasn't a scientific method that enabled Aristotle to go from clear steps. Oh, here I see this, there, until ultimately he discovered clearly, now I have traced the world back to its infinite beginning. And he's still tracing. No. He was considering two equally inconceivable possibilities. He was in a quandary. How is he going to conclude one more than the other? When he was considering the impossibility of both, he ended up reaching the conclusion that the lesser of two evils was that there was no beginning. Because he was stuck with what really was an unresolvable uncertainty. So it's not like he came and he clearly said, this is what makes sense, this is what's clearly evident, this is what must be. It was abstract thought, and with his immense mind, he had an immense mind, with his immense mind, when he weighed all of the factors against no beginning, and all the factors against the factors against the beginning were weightier. But he remained with all kinds of difficulties with the other possibility also. Just, he tipped the scales in that favor because that was the more explicable. Okay? So now, he had no means of simply saying, see, you know what I'll do? I'll ask people, well, who was born before you? Who was born before you? And we'll trace it back to the beginning. He couldn't do that, right? So when he said that the world has no beginning, does that mean that he traced it all the way back? Obviously not. Because wherever he stopped tracing, maybe the world began the year before that. It was abstract philosophical thought. Right? He had no means of determining, well, quite at which point did mankind begin and who came from who. V'ilu hoya filosof b'uma she'incham mikubois mufusamois she'ne yochol itchoseisam. Now, if Aristotle would have been a member of a nation that does have a clear tradition, a tradition that's as substantiable in the Torah, that's as irrefutable as the Torah, what would Aristotle have done? Aristotle would have said, okay, so now my uncertainty has been resolved, right? Now, both are impossible. One has to be. So, for lack of any better resource, he tipped the scales in favor of no beginning. If he would have had the Torah, okay, so even though the Torah seems a little more impossible than no beginning, okay, so the Torah is right. And now we have to begin justifying that stand. What did he do? He worked to substantiate the understanding that the world has no beginning. Why? Because he decided to tip the scales in favor of that possibility. Why? Because that was the less difficult of the two. After he decided that that was the less difficult of the two, he tipped the scales in that favor, and then he started substantiating it. So today you know that Aristotle substantiated the no beginning approach. And that's modern accepted science in those times. But again, he only reached that conclusion because He didn't have a better way of resolving it. Had he had the Torah, what would he have done? He would have said, okay, so then the beginning is the true option, that the world did begin at some point. And he would have spent his time substantiating that, just as he did for the other track. And yes, he would have used all of his philosophical arguments. Yes, he would have used that to substantiate the creation of the world, as difficult as it is. Just the same as he did for the no beginning, which is maybe even more difficult to comprehend. But yet he substantiated it, because it's got to be one of the two. After we decide which is more likely, we go substantiating it.
I can see why Yirmiyahu or Shimon HaTzadik would tell this guy, look at, you know, here's a little bit of information, here's a little bit of Torah education, because this guy is taking it, you know, to the world. So
that's true. That will probably be the justification for those who understand that he did it. Right? Right.
To educate him, and then if he goes with it and he buys it and then he sells it, right, then everybody will agree that the world is 6,000 years
old. Right? Right? Quite possibly. Right? Okay, so in other words, what the Chavir is saying is, Aristotle substantiated this possibility, not because he was led to that conclusion clearly. He had to deliberate. And after tipping the scales in that favor, he substantiated. So Amar Kuzari. So now the Kuzari asks the question that's so common. This is not much relevant to our, what we contend with today too. But at the end of the day, he did substantiate it, right? So after he substantiated it, that means it's substantiated. That means it's been proven. You're saying that yes, he substantiated the no beginning theory. But you're saying that had he had the Torah, he would have gone in the other direction.
What do you mean by substantiated?
What?
What do you mean by substantiated? How did he substantiate anything?
Good. I'm not going to answer your question yet. But I'm not going to answer your question yet. But this is what the King of Kuzar is saying. Anybody who attended high school knows that Aristotle substantiated it. It's taught as fact. It's taught as fact. And the scientists know what they're talking about. Okay? You trust them. Okay. Omer HaChaver. And therefore the Kuzar is asking, what are you saying? If he would have had the Torah, he would have substantiated otherwise. How can you prove otherwise than what's been proven is true? So Omar HaChaver, exactly your question. V'chiyesh moifes, b'moifes, sorry, u'me'ayin lanu moifes b'she'ela azayis. What do you mean, after he substantiated it, how could he have done the opposite? How was it ever substantiated? And that's mamish the point. This is the big point, which we also have to learn to apply today too. Yes, it's been taught as fact. And look, your majesty, King of Kuzar, you grew up believing that this is proven fact. Right? That this has been clearly substantiated. But it isn't true. At the end of the day, it's Aristotle's speculation that he substantiated in the sense that he argued for it philosophically and presented good arguments. But at the end of the day, it remains non-conclusive speculation. So don't be duped by the fact that it's presented as fact. Chalila lakel, listen, this is a fundamental sentence that he says here, with a lot of bearing on contemporary discussions. The chaver, chalila lakel, chas v'chalila, he says, for Hashem, shetovaya teira b'mashe yidche raya amaytas, that the teira would ever conflict with something that can clearly be proven otherwise. Meaning, the Torah will never conflict with something that you can see under a microscope. The Torah will never conflict with something that can be shown in a laboratory. Achtovaya Torah, he says, what the Torah does is as follows. This is how the Torah substantiates it. Beniflois vishanois haminhogim. The way the Torah worked is, we've been through this whole process, what the Torah did was, the Torah showed when it wanted to implement itself, right? When the Torah needed to be presented to the Jewish people. Benifloys v'shanois haminhagim came, showed all kinds of wondrous things, overturned nature, right? This was the introduction to Torah. We saw the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, Hasinai, Lebriyas dvarim, elahapich dovel levar acher. We saw new things being created. We saw things being turned over, nature. La hayroi sal chokhmas boyre oilam v'yicholtoi, lasos mashachofetz ve'is shiachfetz. In order to show, the Torah came and showed empirically that there is a creator who can do whatever he wants. Who's in control and can do whatever he wants. That's how the Torah started, right? That's what we've discussed. That's why we begin with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then, the Torah works backwards. After we've shown you that, look, there is a creator who can do whatever he wants, and he controls all of nature, and he's giving you the Torah, now he is going to inform you how it all began. There's no way of actually going and seeing how it began. Time machine hasn't been created yet. So the only, what the Torah does is, first it comes and shows you 100% clearly that there's a creator. That's what it did in Mitzrayim. Then the creator is coming and telling you, here, and this is what happened. Here's how it began. And yes, could be that at that point already, they were struggling with that dilemma. Is the world, the deep question, did the world begin at some point, or was it always? And the arguments in favor of each were basically on equal footing. Until the argument is decided. Whereas Aristotle's case, it had to be decided for lack of anything better. He just had to go with one instead of the other without having a clear resolution. But here, we came with a clear answer to the question. Hashem handed us a tradition which really was a continuation. Me'adam vad noyach u'moyshe b'nevuah. Which was handed to us Adam through Noach, through Moshe, through the prophecy, Asherim Yin Safek, Yoisa Ne'emenes V'Na'am HaKosha. Which is certainly a better way of resolving that Safek than through further philosophical speculation. We're in mid-sentence, but we're going to stop here. We'll sum it up next week and develop it, Be'ezus Hashem. Thank you.